Call the Tax Committee to order. Members, this evening what we are going to do is we are going to have staff do a walkthrough of the A50792 amendment to House File 785, which is the delete all amendment to the for the omnibus tax bill. So members, what we are going to have staff do is to walk through the delete all amendment and go through the spreadsheet this evening. I would appreciate it if members would try to refrain from extemporaneous discussion of the bill, as we will have ample opportunity to discuss the bill tomorrow and take the tentative plan is to take amendments either Tuesday after session or Wednesday, or and both if necessary. So I said I would appreciate it because we have Ways and Means meeting at 8:30, and we can try to allow staff to go through the bill. And again, if you have technical questions, those are certainly welcome. But as I said, just try to do the best we can to keep on schedule this evening. I don't want to cut anyone off. But as I said, again, the reason for the meeting this evening is to give an opportunity for members as well as the public to understand what is in the 792 amendment as is before us. Then I would also ask if there is anyone present or anyone who knows of an individual or a group that wants to testify in favor or in opposition to the Delete All Amendment 792 to House File 785, that they contact staff to with the name and organization they represent so that we can have the names and organizations they represent lined up for testimony tomorrow. We will committee will meet 9 a.m. Tomorrow morning in this room, again in room 5, 9 a.m. tomorrow, to take public testimony to, again, the 792 delete all amendment to House File 785. So first of all, questions. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, and I guess I'll start with the one related to this bill. I just want to make sure I understand this. Now, I know you must have been real busy because you didn't find much time even to share this with the GOP members of the Tax Committee, so I don't know if it's the congressional race that's got your time all tied up or what it is, but if I got this understood right, you're unveiling this at 6 o'clock, and anybody that wants to testify in favor or against it is supposed to be ready by 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. And is that what I just heard you say, Mr. Chair?
Correct. This bill was released to the public online a half an hour after session adjourned. Obviously, it wasn't my intent that I was told by leadership that we were going to have another one of those short sessions, and that the intent was we were going to meet at least 3 hours ago to start this meeting. But we will take testimony after session tomorrow. We'll take testimony on Wednesday if need be, if there's anyone out there that in any way, shape, or form can't be here or can't submit written testimony. We will be certainly happy to entertain anyone or any comments to the bill. If you want to help me go to the speaker and wait a week or two, we could certainly, I'll be happy to wait a week, a month, or longer to pass a tax bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, the second question deals with the Racino or a combination Racino Casino deal. I watch all this AB stuff go off the floor. I'm beginning to think that, the fact that you haven't scheduled a hearing, they must not want you to. And I don't know, are all the bills supposed to pass off the floor in case it dies? Then they can say, geez, we got it all to conference committee without that, or what next going on here? Why is it that we're doing all this stuff before we have a vote on something that is in all our bills? I guess I'm confused.
Representative Gorman, I think you have to take that issue up with the speaker. I have not had the speaker and majority leader. I said in deference to the, as you know, I had those bills, the two bills, Representative Biskin's bill and Representative Westerberg's bill, scheduled for a hearing some weeks ago. The leadership came to me and said they wanted to postpone the hearings on those bills. I have not heard from them or had contact from them that they want those bills heard, so I haven't scheduled them. When I hear from leadership that they want those bills scheduled in this committee, we will hear them.
I got a sneaking suspicion that'll be shortly after the final ominous bill passes off the House floor.
If you want to,
and people wonder why I'm getting cynical, I don't.
Well, Representative Dorman, if you have some more leverage with them than I do, certainly.
I don't believe so.
Okay. Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering. First, I got three questions. The first of all is the number of. Of your members over there indicative of their support for your bill?
They're trying to read the bill.
Mr. Chair, I want to know when amendments are going to be being offered, and is there going to be a 24-hour rule or not? That would be my first question to you.
First of all, Representative Rucavina, as I stated previously, I do not have a 24-hour rule for committee number one. Number two, we will, when we have finished with public testimony and general committee discussion to the delete all amendment, we will start on amendments, whether that is tomorrow after session or whether that is Wednesday or whether that is Thursday. That's when we will start taking up amendments.
Mr. Chair, you don't know for sure when that is, but your intention is as soon as public testimony is over. And
again, to I think the comment that Representative Dorman raised earlier, yes, we are unveiling the bill today, and I don't want to limit or curtail comments by either the public or by members of the committee, and therefore want to give ample opportunity. So. Again, no time limit for when amendments, and again, in deference to our staff, we would have probably liked to have unveiled the bill last week and had the weekend for people to review it and ask questions about it, but we want to give staff a proper amount of time to explain provisions of the bill to members, ample opportunity for members to contemplate amendments or to get amendments drafted. Obviously, we want to give the staff proper amount of time to draft amendments so that the amendments properly fit the bill and also work in terms of the our budget targets.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, would you, in your opinion, this is, would you say that the little piece in the bill about the Racino fee increase would make the bill germane to gambling amendments? In your opinion.
I usually let speakers make determinations as far as germaneness, so there is a provision for franchise fee for the card club at Canterbury. I suppose that Representative Westerberg might find that germane to a gambling provision, but anyway. Again, members, if I'm not going to try to limit or curtail debate on the legislation, so if someone wants to bring that up, I suppose one thing we could always do is we could always have the committee vote as to whether it's germane, but generally, if we're going to have debate, I think we should have full and open debate in committee. Representative Lynn Chesky.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. Process question as well, following Representative Dorman and Rucavina. And that's very specific to just this evening, and that is, I know a lot of people get frustrated with the tedious nature sometimes of the tax committee, but these are all very serious provisions. I've tried to read through it as quickly as I can, but we now have Joel Michael in front of us, and you know, we really do want to understand these provisions. I heard you say Ways and Means wants to meet, and so there maybe is a sense of urgency, but my concern would be that to help the staff get all those amendments drafted, and there is a, you know, they're working under pressure, we really have to know what's in the bill. So in proceeding with Mr. Michael, will we take questions by each section or have an article done? Or, I mean, I understand you don't want people to editorialize on the whether they think this is a great idea or a bad idea or whatever, but there's a lot of logistics and mechanics in a lot of these sections, and I'm wondering how you want to proceed as far as just the committee members just understanding specifically what's in the bill.
Certainly, I think that's a very valid question. I would prefer if we allow Mr. Michael to go through an article, and then with the explanation of that article, then if there are questions to either specific sections or the overall provision of the article, address questions at that point in time. But again, you're right. I guess I'd like to keep them to a technically what the provision does or doesn't do, or what the fiscal impact of that provision is, if we could. Again, members, I'm not trying to limit debate. I think we'll have ample opportunity both tomorrow and Wednesday to debate the provisions, but I certainly understand that there are going to be technical questions about how the provisions impact tax law or revenue projections. So if there are no further questions at this time, Mr. Michael, I would appreciate your review of, well, first of all, let me actually formally move, the chair moves the 792 delete all amendment to House File 785. Mr. Michael, if you will be so gracious as to step us through the various provisions in the delete all amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible with an eye toward not spending much time on the provisions that have been described. You heard before, particularly...
Mr. Michael, if you could just, the microphone, just pull it over closer to you or slide over so that members of the audience can clearly understand you. Thank you.
I don't know if that sounds like that's better. I'll try to go quickly over the provisions that came from the department bill or that have been heard and discussed by the committee before that haven't been changed much, and focus more on the provisions that are new to the committee. With that in mind, and there may be some times when I want to call on my colleagues for help on provisions that I haven't worked that much on, depending upon how detailed the questions get. But anyway, turning to Article 1, and I'll just go through it in order. Article 1 essentially contains two policy changes. First, it adopts starting for taxes payable in 2000, but not with full effect until 2007, the taxpayer satisfaction survey mechanism, and for taxes payable in 2006, there's a levy freeze that's imposed on cities, counties, and special taxing districts, but not schools. Turning to the Section 1, most of these definitions in Section 1 are just, if you look at it, it's a lot of new language, but most of them have been carried over from the Truth in Taxation law, and so they're really existing law. I guess one difference that's useful to point out is the debt levy is defined somewhat it's defined in this because debt levies will be exempt from essentially being subject to the trigger under the truth and under the taxpayer satisfaction survey, whereas debt levies are really not a relevant factor under the truth in taxation. Turning to Section 3, these are the changes in the notice that goes out with Truth in Taxation in order to accommodate the new taxpayer satisfaction survey. You'll note, first of all, that there aren't any more public hearings because that's eliminated under the taxpayer satisfaction survey. The second thing I think that's worth noting is that all the special taxing districts will now be aggregated on one line on the notice, so there won't be separate lines for each of those special taxing districts. With regard to the taxpayer satisfaction survey, when it's fully implemented under the bill in 2007, each notice will go out with a unique property tax code or description on it that will allow the administering agency to identify the parcel of property that notice comes from. Now, that feature will not be implemented for 2006 because sending the notices back will not trigger a referendum, of course, with a levy freeze in effect for cities, counties, and special districts. There would be no reason to trigger a referendum. There are changes in the proposed budget and property tax levy. Under Truth in Taxation, this was published in the newspaper. This article repeals that, and instead the materials will actually be sent to the taxpayer. Section 6 lays out the format for the survey. Section 7 provides that if more than 20% or if at least 20% of the respondents return the survey, and of course then this is again taxes payable in 2007, that will trigger a referendum on the levy increase, but not the debt levy increase. For 2006, the county is the designated agency that's going to administer the survey. After that, the Commissioner of Revenue is given authority to designate a third-party agency to administer this. The way this works is that if enough of these surveys get returned to trigger a referendum, then the local unit of government has the option of essentially falling back to its levy, the non-increased levy, and then aborting the referendum. If they don't choose to do that, there will be two separate levies that are certified, the lower old levy or the higher levy that they propose, and a vote will be held on it in the first Tuesday in January. And if the vote essentially overturns the higher levy, then the county auditor would certify the lower levy. Section 14 contains the freeze provisions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's first of all worth noting that the debt levy is exempt from this, so essentially if the pre-existing debt levy increased as a result of bonds that have been issued in the past, that would not be affected by the freeze. Secondly, local units of government, if they can, are generally prohibited from issuing new debt during 2006, but there's an exemption from this if they can do that without increasing their debt levy. Subdivision 5 of Section 14 is worth noting that if a local unit, if a county or a city or a special district wishes to exceed to increase its levy over the frozen amount, they are permitted to go to a referendum in order to do that. Subdivision 6 provides that if there's annexed territory, that's taken into account and adjusted the levy so that doesn't result in loss of levy authority as a result of that. I guess the final thing I'd note is that the authority of county sheriffs and county attorneys to go through salary appeals is suspended during this period of the levy freeze in order to prevent that from triggering the need for reallocating spending with the frozen levy. Section 15 contains the repealer for the requirement of publishing the Truth in Taxation budget and levy amounts in the newspaper, and the requirement that TNT hearings be held. Moving on to Article 2.
We're
going
to do Article 1.
Excuse me, Ms. Feinfeld. Okay. Questions to Article 1. Representative Abney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions just needing to clarify my understanding of Section 14. My first question, Mr. Chair, being, does this apply to school districts? They're not named specifically.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, no, it does not. It only applies to cities, counties, and special districts. Schools are exempt from this, and as you've heard from the K-12 bill last week, schools are authorized to increase their levies under that bill. And of course, many of their levy increases are pursuant to referendum, which is something that would be permitted here also for cities and counties.
Mr. Chair, a recollection. The K-12 bill included, am I right, $112 million in increased property taxes across the state?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's right, but I'm not. My colleagues are signaling that it's actually
there
higher.
Appears to be giggling behind me.
I think that's right.
Mr. Hines, you want to come up and give us a... a little more elaboration on the question from Representative Dabney.
There's plenty to giggle about.
Let's go then.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is the correct number. $112 million is the increase.
Excuse me, Mr. Hines, $112 million projected potential property tax increase for pay.
Mr. Chairman, that would be the increase for pay 2006 as the result of the K-12 bill. So on top of the increase that's already in predicted for current law, this would be 112 on top of that.
And the assumption would be that it would be all districts levying to the maximum, or is that a projection of districts that may or may not levy to the maximum?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not positive how to answer that question. That is the number that the staff from the K-12 gave to us when they came before the committee, and I think that assumes generally that people use the authority. There may be some situations where they don't assume everybody uses it, but I think generally they assume they use most of the capabilities.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, my recollection is that kicks in the second year of the bill. Can anyone speak to what happens the third and fourth years going out? What happens? Does that $112 million remain stable, increase, decrease? What's the impact in the following biennium on property taxes under the K-12 bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I'm going to look through to see if I have information on that. Maybe you want to move to a different question, and I'll...
Sorry to put you on the spot, sir. Thank you.
But we'll get that information for you. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Just have Representative Lincheski.
I can wait, Mr. Chair, if it was on. Same thing. The next person. I
don't know. Representative Mueller is to this point or another? Representative Dorman, was that to this point?
It was to the school property tax.
Okay, Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious, again, it would seem to me that to be consistent, that if I understand what you're doing here, is you want to say there's a property tax freeze in place, so we're not raising taxes, then why, you know, go whole hog. You bet, you know, you ought to have it. I don't think it's a good idea, but if you're going to do it, for the reasons I guess I don't know what's in your mind really on that.
Many people have tried to figure that out.
I'm not going to try, but then we ought to do it. We ought to freeze them. I don't know why we're allowing a property tax increase for some areas and not another. And so I guess I'm not expecting an answer now that and we're going through it. But I just wanted to highlight it that it just seems somewhat inconsistent.
Well, Representative Dorman, I think that there are probably a lot of inconsistencies in what we're doing during this legislative session, but certainly if someone wants to offer an amendment to extend this freeze to school districts, that's certainly in order, and if someone wants to offer an amendment to remove the phrase from cities and counties, that's in order as well. Representative Rukavina, to this point?
To this point, Mr. Chair. You know, I signed on to the freeze with you in order to make a point, which I think you wanted to make too, and that's property tax increases are tax increases also. And yet I believe the number that Representative Dabney is looking for in the second year was 183 or something like that for the K-12 bill. I guess my question to you would be, given the fact that I'm on that freeze bill with you and I thought we were on the same page on taxes, a tax, why don't you have the education freeze in here also? And secondly, what other exceptions are there to property tax freezes in the bill regarding counties and cities?
Well, let's go to the your last question first, Mr. Michaels, Mr. Hines. Are there any other exceptions? I mean, I guess first and foremost, that the freeze can be overridden by a referendum, so that would be the one point. Mr. Michael, Mr. Hines, any further elaboration?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's worth pointing out, the referendum exemption. The other thing is, if this city or county had issued debt in the past and that debt required a higher levy next year, that levy is allowed to go up. They're not required to eat that out of their other spending. I think those are really the only two exceptions. And I think it's also worth noting that school district increase levy number that was cited does reflect the staff's estimate of how many referenda will pass. So even if you impose this version of the freeze on schools, that wouldn't necessarily mean that 112 million would drop to zero, because a chunk of that is attributable actually to their estimates of the number of referenda that will pass. In part, one of the factors there that's involved is that they're increasing equalization aid for referenda, which will stimulate increases. And I think even maybe, and Steve could probably speak to this better, but I think that 112 million is over a baseline that may have referendum increases in it too.
So I might.
So those, Mr. Chairman, are just complicating factors when you're dealing with the referendum type exemption.
And Representative Rukavina, to your first question, number one, I voted for the K-12 bill, so I thought it'd be rather inconsistent for me to come back and then say we're going to freeze levies for school districts. The other point, that this is not exactly as the freeze bill was introduced, because the freeze bill did have some buyback provisions for cities and counties, so this is slightly different than the bill that was that I introduced and you co-authored. So if you want to jump off now, Representative Rukavina, I understand.
So, Mr. Chair, then, with your logic there, that since you voted for the K-12 bill, is it safe from me assuming you won't be allowing any transportation levy increases?
Transportation is yet a different subject, isn't it, Representative? So, okay, let's, Representative Earhart, did you have a point to the discussion of property tax for schools, or?
No, it's on another matter, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Lucheski, then.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In section four, which is the taxpayer satisfaction survey, I'm actually reading in the bill on page 8 now, and Article 1, Section 4, page 8. And halfway through the page in paragraph B, it actually lays out the question, are you satisfied with the proposed property tax levy for, you know, fill in the blank, name of the jurisdiction? Is the intention in trying to read through this language quickly that if you, on your property tax statement, you'd answer multiple questions, you know, are you satisfied with the taxes in, say, in my community, Hennepin County, Bloomington, the Mosquito Control District, the Met Council, would it be every taxing jurisdiction except the schools, is that right? And would you get to answer all those questions individually?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucheski, would this be the county and city governments for cities over 500 population? So no other jurisdictions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Luchesko.
Following up on that, and Mr. Chair, you know, I should note if any of the members are actually looking on page 8 at the bottom. Boy, you didn't miss a thing because you even have in paragraph C that you have to pay for your own stamp. So you haven't missed a nickel here. So good for you.
I believe it's 37 cents.
37 cents, yes, Representative Prinky. And Mr. Chair, similarly, and I don't know if I'm in that same section, but just two pages back in the bill on page 5, it's the paragraph E, and it talks about the notice must state for each parcel both the taxes payable in current year and proposed taxes payable in the following year, and then it goes through to list the county tax, city, or town tax. And there's some new language at the bottom there related to fiscal disparities. And is the intent in that portion of this section to have the fiscal disparities tax included now in the property tax statement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, that that, you know, that is currently provided in the proposed notice. You need to get all the pieces in there so that the total amount of tax that is liable from the property is on the bottom line. So, of course, only a commercial property would have any amount showing there on a fiscal disparities tax. And that is the case. Now, really, the only new language is only needed to allow some of the lines to be combined for space on the statement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question on this section is Section 9, which is the cost of preparing the property tax notices and taxpayer satisfaction surveys. And this says it allows the county to apportion the tax, the cost of preparing and mailing these property tax notices and satisfaction surveys, one-third to the county, one-third to the city and town, and one-third to the school districts. And I'm wondering if you can clarify for me if part of the cost is going to go to the schools, you know, and part to the, or third to the county, third to the schools, and third to the city. It seems to me that depending on what county you live in the state, this could be fairly representative of what might be happening fiscally in that county. And then in other parts of the state, it would just really be out of whack. Can you comment on the one-third, one-third, one-third with why that would apply equally to all counties? And I'm just trying to think of a city paying a cost in a huge county versus a city paying one-third of the cost in a county where the city could be almost the whole county. Seems that it just doesn't line up correctly. And
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, one thing I would point out is that is current law, that one-third, one-third, one-third allocation for how the truth in taxation costs are now allocated. So that isn't really changing. And I guess if you think of a big county, if there's lots of cities, then that one-third share between the cities would be split between lots of cities. Whereas if it's one big city in the county, then that big city would have one-third of the cost. It's obviously not a very refined instrument, but it's what's in law now,
I'm sorry, I know I said that was the last question, but
right.
We were talking about the freeze and the schools weren't in the freeze. Are the schools in the postcard? And if the schools are in the postcard, then why are, if they're not in the postcard, then why would they pay a third of the cost? Or is that in there too?
The first of all, the schools are not included in the taxpayer satisfaction survey, and the reason they pay one-third of the cost of the preparation and mailing of the form is because, as Mr. Hines stated, that's current law. So if we want to lessen their cost, this is merely, again, the taxpayer satisfaction is just an addendum to the truth in taxation process that's currently in law. So, okay. Any further questions, Representative Lencheski? Okay. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple questions on the Section 14. The first one is Subdivision 8 on pension liabilities. Says they can't, basically I think it says they can't levy more than in 2005. What if they've set up a schedule for amortization and it that schedule. In other words, you often can set up a schedule for amortizing your pension that increases over the years. So if they have set up that, are you going to then prevent them from going through the amortized schedule so that you'll drop them into a further into a deficit or something, or a deficiency? Is that what that would do? Or can they go ahead if they have an amortization schedule? Can they follow their amortization schedule?
Mr. Michael? As Chairman, Representative Mullery, this provision would not, if they had an amortization schedule like that that increased their pension levy by, say, 10%, this would not allow that. This freezes their pension levy. If they're legally required to make those deposits to the pension fund, they would have to somehow reallocate spending in order to do that.
But often if they're not bonding or something, then they might not be legally required, but they've set up that schedule so you'd be throwing them into a deficiency possibly or whatever. Then is that correct? And that would be what would be required by this law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, this just says that they cannot increase their levy to fund pensions. So it would not, I don't think it would legally affect their obligation or a decision, sort of a policy decision, whether or not they want to continue on that amortization schedule. What it would do is it would constrain their ability to use property taxes to do that. Now, if as I know there are some local governments have done, if they've issued bonds to fund their pension fund, then the bond exception would allow, you know, if their bond payments were going up, they would be allowed under this. But for just a straight levy to deposit in their pension fund, it does not increase. It's frozen.
Even if they're they've set up a plan to get out of their problems that way. Okay, Mr. Chairman, second question.
Mullery.
Is with regard to prohibition against incurring new debt at Subdivision 2. From incurring new debt obligations, is that like GO or, again, I'm looking at some places, they do, for instance, pension obligation bonds or something like that that are not GO. Sometimes they do GO, sometimes they do not GO. How would that affect that? Or is this limited to GO bonds, or is it any?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, this prohibition on incurring new debt is actually keyed more or less off the language that's in the levy limit law for the exception for levies for debt, which is not strictly limited to general obligation bonds. It's broader than that. And it would prohibit them from incurring any of those kinds of debt that were enumerated in that description in the levy limit law. So there are certain things, like if you read through the language on page 14 of the bill, lines 20 and following, for example, you'll see that installment purchase contracts, lease purchase contracts, are in that list. Those are not classic GO debt. So it would be all of the items that are in there that are prohibited. As I indicated before, there's this out that if incurring the debt doesn't compel them or won't result in them increasing their debt levy for 06 over 05, then they can go ahead and issue and sell. Actually, it's tied to selling the debt. Then they can go ahead and sell the debt. But they can't if it would trigger a levy increase. And there are also exceptions for refunding bonds, for example, as you would guess would be the case.
Mr. Chairman, just
Representative Mullery, if we need to move along here, so if you have specific questions of detailed nature, I suggest that you talk to staff either later this evening or know, again, we can ask these questions tomorrow. But again, we're getting into a level of technicality here that I think is slowing us down to a point where I'd like the staff to be able to move through this in the next 2 hours to give us an overall presentation of the bill, not only for members but for the public as well as people in the audience here. So, is that Representative Mullery? So, I understand you want to clearly understand that provision, but there's some very technical provisions there. So, the Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple questions on the taxpayer satisfaction survey and levy freeze. I'm reading from the overview, and it talks about certified by the county and indicating dissatisfaction with the preliminary levy that has been certified by the county, in some cases by the city. Mr. Chairman, what are the exceptions to the city, or what causes the city to be included here?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, cities with populations of under 500 are not subject to this, so that's why that reference says some cities.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Earhart,
more than 20% of the survey responses indicate taxpayer dissatisfaction. That seems like a very low threshold. I'm just going to leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And would cause a referendum election to be triggered. Now, if the referendum election is not successful, meaning that that the referendum does not agree with the levy that's been certified, it then reverts to the previous year. Do I understand the levy then reverts to the previous year? Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct, Representative.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, what is the time frame on this? I see that the time frame is November 10th through November 24th for delivery notices, but how about return and referendum times? Are they all done in the month of November or December or what?
Representative Earhart, we have information that we can hand out to the members. We will give you the time frame as well as the details. One thing, Representative Earhart, is that the taxpayer satisfaction referendum or the trigger mechanism does not take place in 06. It takes place for payable taxes payable in 07, so that 20% threshold could be moved up or down dependent upon experience from the surveys going out in the fall of 2005 if this were to become law.
Mr. Chairman, what you're saying is there hasn't been a timetable worked out yet.
No, we do have a proposed timetable.
Okay.
Representative Earhart, we will hand that out for you. So any other questions, Representative Earhart?
No, I guess not, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Met Council, as far as the, if I understood the line of questioning, Met Council
one
is
vote.
Outside of the freeze, and I'm just, since they if I understand, I'm no expert on the Met Council, but they provide some services that are similar to what cities provide in Roman. So why are they outside the freeze?
Representative Dorman, they are a special taxing district. They would be subject to the freeze except for bond payments.
Why
am I correct, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They are all special districts, including the Met Council, would be subject to the freeze. I think perhaps the confusion is that on the taxpayer satisfaction survey, it only applies to cities and counties and would not apply to watersheds and soil and water conservation and the Met Council.
So, that, Mr. Chair, their taxes are froze, but you said except for what?
Except for the the exception that the bond or debt service payments, I'm sorry, debt service payments, which they're exempt, all the cities, counties, and the special taxation districts would be exempt from debt service payments increases. Okay. So, If we can move on, then, members to Article 2.
Mr. Chairman, could I just get back to say that Representative Davenport's question earlier, the
Mr.
amount
Hines.
Of those levies in the out years estimated for the next 2 years are $181 and $183 million, respectively.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davenport.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, I hate to put you on the spot again, and but do you know... As I recall, there's a reverse referendum language in the K-12 bill, and I can't remember whether it's for some of these property tax levies that are included in the bill. I do remember it is for the special education levy. There's a reverse referendum function. I don't remember whether it's for all. Do you have a sense of the, maybe the percentage of these levies that are eligible for the reverse referendum?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, from my recollection, there's only one of the new levies that's subject to reverse referendum. You believe that it's special ed, and I couldn't even say that for sure, but I do remember that it was a fairly small amount subject to that.
All right. But thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hines.
Okay. Thank you. If we could continue then, Article 2, Mr. Mike.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, turning to Article 2, one of two property tax articles, so I'll move through quickly. The first seven sections are all of the electric generation facility exemptions that were heard by the committee, Representative Westrom's biomass facility, Representative Ellison's Crown Hydro, Representative Fritz's Faribault project, Representative Dempsey's Cannon Falls project, Representative Beard's Shakopee project, Representative Eastland's Cambridge project. Section 9 is a generic exception for all new electric generation facilities, similar to what was passed in the 2004 tax bill. Section 10 is a provision from Representative Vandeveer that requires a supermajority for a county to take over the assessing function from a town or a city. Section 11, again, is a Representative Vandeveer provision that provides for training and education of property tax personnel for seminars for assessors. Section 12 is Representative Vandeveer's two-year extension of limited market value and extending it to all types of property, not just the limited set that it now applies to. The threshold is the threshold that applies under present law for taxes payable in 2006, the 15% and 25%. Section 13 is Representative Simpson, or a version of Representative Simpson's provision for Class 1 resort property that essentially extends a version of limited market value to those resort properties. Section 14 came again from the division report from Representative Vandeveer's division that requires all denied Green Acres applications to be forwarded to the Department of Revenue. Section 15 is Representative Goodwin's bill providing for a abatement for properties with mold. Section 16 is a manufactured home provision that under certain circumstances allows properties to be transferred without payment of tax on the entire park. Section 17 reinstates 4D project 4D class rate at 1% for deemed project only. Section 18 contains two provisions. One is the classification reduction and restructuring in Representative Simpson's bill for homestead resorts, and Representative Nornes's increase in the amount of value that qualifies for the blind and disabled class rate of 0.45%. Section 19, and most of these provisions, again, are coming from the Property Tax Division. Section 19 is Representative Howe's bill that extends the treatment for aircraft hangars to owned property, not just that on leased land. Section 20 is Representative Rukavina's bill that provides a $200,000 valuation exclusion for the homesteads of disabled veterans or their surviving spouses. Section 21 is Representative Thiessen's bill that provides that units of government that acquire properties are required to pay an amount of property taxes to the other units of government that will lose property tax base as a result of the acquisition. Section 22 is a provision that allows the local board of review to grant evaluation reductions even if the owner of the property has denied the assessor access to the property. Section 23 is Representative Lanning's bill that segments the state general tax into a pot for seasonal recreational property and for CI property so that those two will not, there won't be shifting between those two shares. Section 24 is Representative Lesh's bill for the Ramsey County Library levy. In addition, there's a provision in it that requires regional rail authority levies to be separately stated on the property tax statement. Section 25 is Representative Otrimba's bill. It requires assessors to provide notification to properties of their rights to appeal. Sections 26 through 30 change the property tax refund from a system that currently is based on 19% of rent as the assumed amount of rent counting constituting property taxes back to the old system that existed back in 1997 and before that uses the actual property taxes that are paid by the property. Section 31 and 32 are Representative Blaine's bill that was part of the tax bill in 2004 that essentially allows towns to spend more than their levy. Sections 33 and 34 allow municipalities, cities, and towns to opt out of the levy for regional rail authorities that are imposed typically in a county. Section 35 creates a special taxing district to fund the Hiawatha Light Rail line. This would use a tax increment-like procedure that would capture the growth in taxes as a result of increases in tax capacity within a corridor that's 1,000 feet on either side of the light rail line. And the original tax capacity rate for this district is also adjusted up for inflation, so that taxing districts would get an inflationary increase based on the average increase in their jurisdiction for that property, but the amount of tax that's paid on capacity above that would go to fund the operation of the Hiawatha Light Rail Line. Section 36 is Representative Mariani's bill that again passed in 2004 for the excludes the Holman Airport from the fiscal disparities. Sections 37 through 41 are Representative Anderson's bill that provides for an increase in the PILT payments from the 37.5 cent category to the 75 cent per acre category. Section 42 is Representative Wilkins' bill, again a rerun from 2004 for the Capone Art Park. Section 43 is Representative David's bill allowing extending the sunset for emergency medical services special taxing districts that would allow a longer period of time for those districts to be created. Sections 44, 40, and 45 are again from the division report that relate to assessment standards and provide a code of conduct or ethics for assessors. Section 46 freezes the regional rail levies of regional rail authority levies until those entities enter into a contract providing for operation of a rail line, essentially. Section 47 is Representative Broad's bill that provides for an alternative tax base for school district debt levy. Section 48 is Representative Hausman's bill for the Great River Charter School, providing a one-year exemption for that property. And Section 49 is part of Representative Wilkins' Capone Yard Park bill. There are no questions. Turning to Article 3.
Excuse me, Michael. Questions to Article 2? Representative Winchester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Section 46, freezing the Regional Rail Authority, and I'm just trying to understand what this is doing. Is this, I suppose it's for any regional rail authority. I don't know much about rail authority, so I don't know if that just exists in the metro or if it exists. There's regional rail authorities everywhere, but if I look at the North Star Community Rail Line, would the impact of this be that the Regional Rail Authority has a property tax freeze in their levy until they've signed a contract for the whole thing? I guess I'm not understanding what Section 46 does.
Being
a North Star Commuter Rail instance.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that they would need to enter into a contract that would, I don't have the underlying statute in front of me, but I believe they'd have to enter into a contract with, for example, the owner of the rail line, which I believe in that case would be Burlington Northern Santa Fe or BNSF or whatever that entity is called, before they could increase their levy. So in other words, it essentially says that they have to have a contract in place that, you know, is sort of the condition precedent to actually beginning operations.
Representative Luchesky.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And similarly, Mr. Michael, on Section 33 of Article 2, this says that, again, related to regional rail authorities, that municipalities can opt out of this provision, and the summary just says allows any municipality to opt out of regional rail authority to by resolution. And I'm just thinking, to me, this sounds like it's both a Hiawatha, a light rail, and a North Star provision, with maybe other rail authorities. I'm not familiar with them, but for example, could if it would apply to a light rail situation or commuter rail, could a city and the county that's paying part of the operating, for example, my city, Bloomington, could it just say, since Hennepin County has to pay half of the operating costs of light rail, Bloomington's going to opt out and no longer pay its portion into the county for that regional rail authority?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. What this provision allows them to do is to opt out of the regional rail authority levy. I do not know, for example, when you're talking about the Hiawatha line or the North Star line, for example, whether that's the authority that they're actually using to levy for that or whether it's a general county levy or something like this. But what this provision does is allow them to opt out of the levy that's imposed as a regional rail authority. So whether or not, you know, how it would apply in those specific circumstances, neither Steve or I know. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Luchesky.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. Could I personally get that information to prepare amendments, possibly? And then last, similar on the same line of questioning, is Section 35, which does say is the special taxing district for light rail transit. And I'm trying to understand exactly how this would work now. I think, Mr. Michael, you said that there's some counting, some adjustment to the original tax capacity. You're adjusting for some percentage equal to, I think you said, the average change in the tax capacity of all the CI property in the county. So I'm just trying to understand the mechanics. So say, for example, you were going to put all of the properties abutting the Hiawatha line in, say, my city, in the city of Bloomington, that are within 1,000 feet, like, say, the Mall of America, and you were going to include any TIF monies that are coming into that now would instead go to pay for light rail, except you would adjust for annually a average of the net tax capacity of all the CI property in all of Hennepin?
Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, first of all, this would not apply where there's an existing TIF district until that TIF district is decertified. And then the current value would be certified and the growth would be after that. So the example of the Mall of America, which is in a TIF district, is not a good example. But let's take another parcel. And I think the way you described it is correct. So let's say development happens on that parcel and it goes up by several hundred percent, but the average CI values in the county are going up by 5% a year or something like that. Every year, the original value, the value that's certified by the county auditor, would be adjusted up by whatever that percentage increase in CI, and that the taxes that are paid by the original value are what go to the county and the city and the school and so forth to pay for their general operations. So if a large development, like a big office building or an apartment building or something like that, were built in this corridor, that increase would go, the taxes paid by that increase would go to pay for light rail operations. But every year a little bit of that would be eaten away if it's not growing as fast as CI is growing in the county.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Just trying to understand that calculation, and this is a mechanical question, so I do want to answer now, and I know I'm taking committee time, but I do want to understand it. So it wouldn't apply where there is a certified TIF district, but when there's going to be a new district, TIF or other, if there's going to be anything happening around the light rail transit line within 1,000 feet, the majority of the money is going to go to pay for operating light rail, except for this small part that would be a declining source. Is there somewhere else in the bill that allows that the city that has to service that, say, 1,000 new residential properties or, however many tens of thousands of square feet of CI, is there anywhere that the city then can collect the revenue it needs to service that new development?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, essentially the only revenue they would get is the tax derived from the original tax capacity. To the extent that they, levy other fees or other charges on the property, they would have that. But
Representative Rupavino.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Michaels, just now back on Section 33, and you can get me the answer tomorrow, or maybe unless you know what now, but would that affect, like, the St. Louis Lake and Itasca County Aboriginal Rail Authority, and they also fund the Mesaba Trail with it. Could one of those counties opt out under that provision, or is it just Core Metro?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, no, this, to the extent there are regional rail authorities, as you indicated, all across, I don't know how many, but I know that there are some out in rural areas of the state, and this would apply there as well. I'm not sure whether municipality is defined to be I think it's defined to be a county. I'll have to check on that. So it's conceivable, I suppose, that the county could opt out. I think what's normally envisioned is that a town would opt out or something like that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know why this is in here. I suspect why. But anyway, I don't want it negative repercussions after we've helped build bike trails from the Itasca County line as an example to Grand Rapids.
You don't believe in local control, Representative?
Well, not after we've paid to build their bike trail and then we still got a little bit of ours left. No.
Okay, if there are no further questions, starters.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael, I'm looking at Section 26, changing the method for determining the percentage of rent constituting property taxes. My understanding is that current law fixes a rate at 19% of rent is attributed to property taxes on the property, and that was done to simplify the computation process for everyone. And this, as I understand it, would require that the percentage of rent attributable to property taxes be calculated separately for each property that a landlord owns. Am I correct on that? How long has it been that we've had a fixed rate in law, and am I correct that my understanding was that it was to kind of simplify everybody's life?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, that I'm not totally sure about the time periods, but the rent credit was enacted in 1967 and was a percentage of rent at that point, and I think it was in 1982 or 83 that it was converted to actual property taxes. And from 1983, I think, to 1997, actual property taxes were used, and then it switched back to the percentage of rent that we have now. One of the reasons for doing that is that it is simpler. Both the Department of Revenue and landlords in 1997 testified that they preferred the percentage of rent because it is simpler. Another reason for doing it was that the property tax reform that was starting at that time was reducing the taxes on apartment buildings, and there was a concern that that would reduce the credit that's paid to the tenants, and so by fixing it at a percentage, that effect was that there wouldn't be that effect of reducing apartment property taxes did not immediately flow through the tenants. But simplification was definitely a factor in making that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Any other questions to Article 2? If not, we'll move on to Article 3.
Article 3 contains changes in the property tax fees and credits. Sections 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, and various others comes from I can't remember whether it's the Department of Revenue's bill or the governor's bill, but essentially this is a more or less technical change that changes the rules for certifying population that's used in calculating LGA, particularly for the Met Council, and allows cities to challenge those values. Section 2 is a provision from the governor's bill that relates to fractional homesteads so that they don't get a larger market value credit than non-fractional homesteads of the sort of the same combined value would. And that has a small revenue savings to the state. Section 7 is Representative Cornish's LGA provision that phases cities whose population goes over the 2,500 threshold onto the big city formula gradually so they don't have an abrupt change in their aid payment. Sections 9, 10, and 11, again, are from either the governor's bill or the Department of Revenue bill. Sections 12, 13, and 14 are a number of changes in the LGA formula. Essentially what this does is, later on in the sales tax article of the bill, it authorizes Minneapolis and St. Paul to impose an additional 0.5% local sales tax that they can use for general fund purposes. And this treats their ability to impose that tax as capacity under the LGA formula. Secondly, if you'll see down in Section 14, the appropriation for LGA and for taxes payable in 2006, that's fiscal 07, is reduced by $17.5 million. The combination of those effects allows an increase in the amount of unmet need that's essentially covered or paid by the formula to increase from 84% to 90%. For taxes payable in 2007, fiscal year 2008, the LGA appropriation returns to the level that's in current law, provided that the taxpayer satisfaction survey provisions go into effect. And so that once that's done, then the percentage of unmet need that's covered by the formula increases to just a little bit less than 100%. And there's another provision which is in Section 8 that says that if the level of unmet need were to exceed 100%, that then instead the average tax rate gets adjusted down so that you're not paying more than 100% of unmet need. Section 17 is the governor's cuts in the market value credit reimbursement for cities that's extended for two more years that were enacted in 2003. There are no questions. I think what I will do is to skip over entirely.
Excuse me, Mr. Michael. We have a question on Section 3. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 3, Article 14, this is the LGA. And it might be in Section 12, too. I'm not sure where you said it, but this idea of linking the tax pay, it is Section 14, for, I think, I'm not sure if this is just applying to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, or everybody, but the section where the state's gonna appropriate, go down to $419 million, that it pays out in LGA, and then it's gonna come back up to $437 million in LGA, but only if the taxpayer satisfaction surveys in Article 1 are in effect, so it's linking the turbocharged postcards to future LGA payments from the state. Reading those numbers, dipping down and then coming back up, you said that, Mr. Michael, that these Section 12 and Section 14, I think in tandem, allow the state to claim that it's funding LGA from 84% to 90% of the formula. It moves from 84 to 90%. Is that correct? Okay, so then thereafter, that's in that first year, we go from 84% funding LGA to 90% funding LGA, and then we return the maximum amount paid in LGA to $437 million with the turbocharged postcards. At what level, then, are we at? If we've gone from 84 to 90, are we up to 95, or what's the percentage paid of LGA?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, under the rest of the formula, it means that we would pay 99% of unmet need.
Of unmet need. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair? Any further questions? Representative Rukavina, Article 3?
Mr. Chair, in Article 3, under the formula, under Subdivision 8 or in Section 12, I guess, you know, I can say welcome to my colleagues from St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth to the anti-DFL representative, I guess, amendment this would be, and senator and representative. You know, when the tax bill left the House floor, Representative Krenke, that in 2003 when we did the taconite offset, it had sales tax, I believe, for everybody's deduction, and I guess it being deducted. And I guess I would ask why you only go to cities of the first class when Rochester and other cities have a sales tax. And, you know, I mean, since this is your provision.
Representative Rukavina, first of all, really, it is based on the cities of the first class ability to raise revenue locally, and also the, as you well know, the cities of the first class, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, obviously receive approximately, is it total?
30%.
I'm sorry, 30% of the total local government aid. So That's the rationale, that these are the cities that receive a significant amount. They're also the cities that have the ability to raise more revenue locally, and therefore the reason for the offset.
Mr. Chair, I would imagine if you put Rochester in there, even though it's not a city of the first class, that I think Rochester, with all the, you know, sheiks and everybody else that come to Rochester, probably has the ability to raise a little bit of money. So I'm you know, and if you throw them in the formula, I don't know what they are, but, you know, they got a pretty good reduction in the O3 bill. Why you wouldn't have them in there?
Representative Rukavina, again, this takes Minneapolis and St. Paul cities of the first class. Rochester is not a city of the first class. This takes cities of the first class and puts them all on the same footing. If there are people who want to, you know, add the you know, St. Cloud, Moorhead, and Rochester, they're certainly willing. You know, Representative Lanning, I don't know if you want to impose a 1% local option sales tax and get an LGA offset. You think you want to do that, Representative Lanning?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we've heard from Moorhead.
That's the point. That's the point exactly, Mr. Chair. You know, Rochester and Duluth, there's really no difference in the population, very little. And yet, because one's a city of the first class, and because there's a, you know, one's a city of the first class and one technically isn't, the ability to raise revenue, you know, under a sales tax is about the same. With all, especially in Rochester, they're raising revenue probably on a much bigger percentage of folks that don't live in that city. It just seems rather unfair. Like, now, Mr. Chair, I was hoping that you would get rid of that unfair provision altogether, which...
you mean LGA?
No, when, no. I mean, what I, Mr. Chair, what I mean is the taconite municipal aid offset, which somehow got put in that bill in 03 when nothing else did when it, regarding sales tax. Now, at least you're... You know, at least you're moving towards fairness in that you're not only, you know, opposing the Iron Range, but also Minneapolis and St. Paul for electing Democratic members of the legislature. So I commend you for that fairness anyway.
Ms. Dalton, how long has Duluth had a 1% local option sales tax, and what? How long have they had a general purpose for that 1%?
Mr. Chair, Duluth local sales tax has been in effect longer than anybody, any other city that, Mr. Michael thinks that somewhere in the middle 1970s, they've always been able to use it for general purposes. The reason this is limited to the first class cities is because Duluth is for general purposes, and the new local sales tax is being authorized for Minneapolis and St. Paul would also be allowed, they'd be allowed to use the money for any general city services as well.
Any further, Representative Mullery?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalton, you know, you say this is only applying to Minneapolis, St. Paul, because of their ability to raise it. How does a first-class city have any more ability than somebody else to raise it? I would disagree with Representative Rukavina. I think Rochester has a far greater capacity to raise sales tax than Duluth. And I'm just thinking of offhand St. Cloud, Bloomington, Edina. If we look at them on a per capita basis, I would guess there's an awful lot higher ability to raise sales tax in some of those than in some of the first class cities. And so why are we distinguished? Why Representative Lanning doesn't seem to think this is a great, wonderful thing that that his city should jump into. What is the justification for this? And what ability does... do you have some statistics on the ability of Edina, Bloomington, Rochester, St. Cloud, Roseville, whatever? I can't think offhand. There's probably other ones in... I can't think as to per capita base ability to raise sales tax. Eden Prairie.
Mr. Representative Mullery, the situation is, I don't know if Representative Lincheski, Representative Earhart, does Edina want a local option sales tax?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have Southdale. And that should raise some taxes, sales tax, right?
Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Mullery, I don't I haven't seen legislation or referendums or requests from those cities that you mentioned, other than St. Cloud, to actually impose a local option sales tax. So I don't know that. And then to your second point, Ms. Dalton can give you a response to when we say the ability to raise means that if you impose it, the amount of money that is brought in by the additional, both Minneapolis and St. Paul would recoup far more than they, I shouldn't say far more, they would recoup more revenue with this half-cent sales tax than they would lose under the LGA offset.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that would probably be true of the other cities that I mentioned also. And the second thing is, I see two members of the Minneapolis delegation here, and I don't think that we're exactly asking for a sales tax. In fact, I've been very opposed to it.
Well, I think
I'm
your
not
mayor
sure that
said
Representative that Lesch is jumping forward.
I think Representative Mullery, I believe that the mayor of Minneapolis said that he supported an increase in the Hennepin County sales tax option in order to finance a stadium. So maybe they could accomplish this without coming to the legislature for an additional authorization for sales tax increase.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think he hasn't done that because people are trying to, from what I've heard on the news, they're trying to nail him down on it, and he has not said that.
Well, we can get Mayor Ryback in here to respond, I guess. But, Ms. Dalton, you want to speak to the definition of ability to raise local revenue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when I was talking about ability to raise revenue, no other city has the authority to impose a sales tax for general city services. Duluth currently does, and in this bill, Minneapolis and St. Paul are given the authority to do that in Article 8. If you gave that authority to Rochester, Edina, Bloomington, because they're already off the LGA formula, it would not matter because there's nothing to offset.
Mr. Chairman, we could. You could still give them that authority. Now, if they, I'll have to look at other cities, and I'm sure you have this. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll do this afterwards and try and get some information from her on other cities.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like to think of fully funding LGA to the previous formulas that we had for LGA. How much money would it take to get back to the former level of LGA funding? Do you recall that, Ms. Dalton? I don't have that committed to memory. I'm thinking what it would take to our suburban districts that I represent, the inner ring suburbs. They lost a lot of local government aid and will be down to zero. Do you know what it would cost to about?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, that would be kind of a hard question to answer because a lot of their aid was grandfathered aid. It wasn't formula aid. So unless you were just willing to reinstate the grandfather, which I would guess would cost about, it would cost a little over $300 million. It's hard to say how much you would have to increase what was paid under the formula and how far you would have to reduce the effort rate to get those cities back onto the formula.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Earhart.
I'm not sure I figured this out, Mr. Chairman, but what's the maximum state exposure to increased LGA under this bill without eliminating the sales tax thing here that might or might not take place? Is there an amount that is going to be distributed LGA more or less?
Ms. Dalton, I believe the question is the additional LGA distribution total.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the total appropriation for LGA goes down $17.5 million from current law in 2006, and it will either stay at that reduced level or it will go back to the $437 million currently in law if the taxpayer satisfaction surveys go into effect.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, the market value credit reimbursement remains in effect. The reductions for the cities that also is remains the same. The reduction is.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the reductions that are in the bill are the ones that were recommended by the governor, which would be a $17.8 million reduction for tax for age payable and market value credit payable in 2005, and $17.5 million in for market value credits in 2007.
Thank you.
Okay, members, could we move on to Article 4, please? Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Article 4 is the Department of Revenue's property tax provisions, and I think since all of these provisions have been gone over by the department before, what I'll do is I'll skip over that and just point out the two provisions of the department's bill that were dropped. One was the provision that I know that a number of members were concerned about requiring landlords to electronically file certificates of rent paid. That's dropped from this. And the second one was imposition of increased penalties for people who had falsely had homestead properties. So both of those two provisions are dropped. Otherwise, these provisions, with some minor modifications requested by department staff, are the provisions that were in the department's articles of the property tax bill. Moving on to Article 5, which contains the income, corporate franchise, and estate tax provisions, running through this quickly, this article contains essentially the same military subtraction provisions that were in the House Omnibus Tax Bill in 2004 that converts the treatment of active military as non-residents to allowing them a subtraction for their military compensation. Sections of 3 through 12 are all from either the Department of Revenue's bill or from the governor's bill, and I won't go through those details unless someone wants me to. Section 5 is a new provision that requires the Commissioner of Revenue to include information in the instruction booklet for the income tax about payment of local use tax for city and county use tax. This is sort of analogous to the information that the department puts in about paying state use tax. Sections 12 and 13. 13 is the, I know some members asked questions about this when it was heard. This is the increase or the imposition of penalties for individuals who either intentionally or with reckless disregard claim refundable credits such as the working family credit, dependent care credit, and so forth. Section 14 contains provisions related to the military that changes that non-resident treatment that I referred to, and it also modifies the domicile test for Minnesota residency, and you can see on the summary those bulleted items are factors that are not to be considered in determining whether an individual is a Minnesota domiciliary or not. So, for example, whether they use a Minnesota bank or their churches in Minnesota and so forth, those factors would not be considered. Section 15 is a new provision that attempts to establish a bright line test for old trusts to determine whether or not they're Minnesota trusts or not. Under present law, the standard is whether the trust is administered in Minnesota, and that obviously is sort of an amorphous standard, and this instead provides a three-part test that if the trust fails two of those parts of the test, then it is a Minnesota trust that's subject to tax on its income in Minnesota. Section 16 contains additions to taxable income. Again, most of these are from the department's provisions. I'll talk about the third bullet later when we get to the subtractions. The subtractions are in Section 17. this is where the subtraction that was in the governor's bill and a couple members, I think Representative Severson had this, a separate bill that allowed Minnesota National Guard to subtract their pay when they are on active service in Minnesota. So when they're called up to deal with a flood or a tornado or something like that, that income for Minnesota National Guard members would qualify for this subtraction. There's also this new subtraction for military service that's done outside Minnesota, which, as I indicated before, is exempted now by treating those folks as non-residents. Representative Paulson's organ donation bill, which was in the 2004 tax bill, is also in this bill. Section 20 is Representative Erdahl's dairy investment credit, with the cap reduced to $1 million. Sections 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26 are all from the department or the governor's bills on with regard to the various adjustments to the credit. So substance, the long-term care credit, this will allow people to claim it even though they may be claiming the itemized deduction for those premiums. Section 27 are changes to the K-12 credit based on bills that Representative Vandeveer and Knobloch had. These changes raise the family cap so that families with more than two children could get more than $2,000 in credit, and it also allows them to distribute the amounts they paid among their children as they see fit. So one child could get more than $1,000 credit if that's where the spending was. Section 28 is Representative Sikora's bill that allows a 50% credit up to a maximum of $1,000 for contributions to school tuition organizations. Section 29 is an AMT subtraction for the military pay and organ donors. Section 30 is a version of Representative Abrams' bill that attempts to increases the exemption under the alternative minimum tax in four steps from the current level of $40,000 to $50,000 for tax year 2008. Section 32 is again from the from the governor's bill on single sales apportionment. This phases in single sales apportionment starting in tax year 2007 over 3 years, so the state would be at 100% sales apportionment by tax year 2009. With section 34, the bill allows a series of income tax checkoffs. Section 34 is a checkoff for the National Guard and Reserves. This was Representative Newman's bill. Section 35 is a public safety officer checkoff. I believe Representative Davids and Zellers had this bill. Section 36 is Representative Cox's bill that allows six different checkoffs for K-12 education, higher ed, transportation, health care, nursing home, and clean water. Section 37 is an administration provision with regard to the checkoffs, and this allows, since the bill adds 10 checkoffs, this allows or provides a mechanism for eliminating the checkoffs if one of the checkoffs over a two-year period does not raise at least $10,000 from at least 8% of all the returns that are using the checkoffs. The two existing checkoffs for non-game wildlife and for political contributions would not be subject to that possibility of being eliminated. Section 38 is Representative Abrams' bill that exempts publicly traded partnerships from the withholding on non-residence requirements. Sections 39 and 40 are governor's estate tax provisions that eliminate the circular computation of essentially where the estate tax is itself deductible in computing the estate tax. Also in Section 40 is an allowance for a Minnesota-only qualified terminable interest election, and this would take effect for decedent dying starting in 2007. The summary is wrong where it says June 30th. That should be December 31st, 2006. Sections 41 and 42 are just conforming provisions under the occupation tax for the single sales apportionment that denies mining companies the benefit of single sales. That's the provisions of Article 5.
Questions, Article 5. Representative Lynchewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Four?
Five.
Article 5.
Mr. Chair, on Section 30 on AMT, trying to find it here quick. If I'm reading this correctly, this says part of Representative Abrams' bill, and it doesn't do the charitable deduction part, but looking at the little phase-in chart on the alternative minimum tax exemption amount, Section 30, and I see we're going to go from $40,000 to $50,000 for exemptions over the next 4 years, and can you just remind me in Representative Abrams' bill, how fast did he get up to $50,000? Is this the timetable he had laid out?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember. I think it was faster than this, that it went maybe in 2 years. I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Lynchewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's Section 14. The definition of non-resident, no. Yeah, the modifying the domicile test for Minnesota residency for income tax purposes. I guess other than this provision, and I don't know if this one even applies because I'm just looking at it in a vacuum here, the foreign operating corporation concerns that many have, and the compliance money that was carried in the tax bill or in the state of finance bill, if that provision isn't related, and I don't think it is, where in this bill, because we're now in the article that we should be able to see the tax compliance parts, if anything's going to be done about the FOC issue and concerns people have about foreign operating corporations, is there anywhere in this article that's being addressed? And do you know what I'm talking about? The state of finance bill carried the tax compliance money, and I think most of that was related to just giving the department more money for compliance so they could go get more money. And I think none of that was related to the foreign operating corporation part, but is there any change in the bill that addresses those concerns at all?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynchewski, there are no changes in the foreign operating corporation rules in the bill, and the appropriation for compliance is carried in the state government finance bill. I think that a portion of that was thought to be, you know, used in the corporate area, which obviously could affect foreign operating companies, but I don't believe it was ever sort of explicitly for foreign operating companies.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. In Section 37, I think, Mr. Michael, you misspoke, I think, and you said that if these new checkups fail to receive at least $10,000, I think you meant $100,000 of contribution, $100,000, that's right. You have all these checkups in here that are Representative Cox and Zellers and Davids and I don't know who all, I think Newman's bills. And then you have a provision, or not you, but you're introducing the bill. There's a provision that says if these things don't actually generate money, they'll go away. And can you tell me, in general, do any of the checkoffs, or the two we have now, what do they generate? Is this something that sort of guaranteed in a couple of years are going to go away? Or, I mean, I guess I'm trying to get, is this a high bar or a low bar, $100,000?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynchewski, I believe that the non-game wildlife checkoff raises in the millions. I think 2 million? 1 million, Nina's signaling to me. And so I don't know. It's your judgment as to how high or low this bar is. You know, if that checkoff raises a million, then this would be one-tenth of that for these other, and they have a two-year period to try to, you know, they have two attempts at the bar, so to speak. I think that there are other states that, you know, employ a similar kind of a mechanism where they drop checkoffs off, and there are some other states that have, you know, in the, I think I saw one state that had over 20 checkoffs. So,
and members, I might just comment again. The rationale here was that there were a number of members that came forward with this checkoff idea. So it's a situation whereby essentially an experiment to say, okay, you have an idea for a checkoff, we'll put it on a separate form, we'll allow it to go forward, but rather than just continuing in perpetuity, we had a mechanism by which if they didn't raise money, it would drop off. So that's the rationale. Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Michael, could you just explain, the wildlife checkoff is right on the form as you go down it. Would these be right on the form as you go down it, or is it on something separate? And if it's on something separate, isn't the likelihood of it not getting anywhere near as much very high as Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, the Commissioner of Revenue has the authority to, you know, determine the format and the, you know, the way that form looks. You're right, the wildlife checkoff, the non-game wildlife checkoff now is on the M1 form, you know, on the front. I think what's envisioned here is that there would be a checkoff line on the front of the M1, and then there would be a separate form that would have all of the checkoffs on it, where you would put a dollar amount on the front on the M1 that says, okay, the checkoff is $500, but then the other form would indicate, well, 400 of that goes to the non-game wildlife checkoff and 100 goes to the National Guard checkoff or something like that. So there would be, I think the only practical way to administer something like this would be with a separate form that has these checkoffs with, you know, lines where you can enter dollar amounts and so forth, and that would have to be carried over to the main M1 form.
Representative Miller,
to clarify, so the wildlife one would also be on this separate form, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
That's all.
Okay, if there's no further, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dabney.
Excuse me, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, I'm looking at sections 26, and maybe 28 as well. And I'm noticing, I'm on page 159 under section 26, they're changing the definition here, updating with language about required academic standards being the definition for when the tax credit can be used, and that's found again as found again on page 160, but then when we go to section 28, when we go to the definition of qualified school, there's no reference to implementing the state academic standards as there is under the tax credit provision. And I'm wondering if either the chair or Mr. Michaels can explain the incongruity there. Incongruity? What's the word I'm looking for?
Discrepancy.
Discrepancy. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. The taconite tax.
Yeah.
No, the discrepancy there.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't know that I can explain the incongruity.
Nicely done.
That this, I think, the change that you note was recommended by the Department of Revenue as a result of changes in the education law, and that so that came from the Department of Revenue bill. Section 28 is Representative Sikora's bill. And, you know, that is just the standard that she put in her bill. I'm not sure. I don't know. Nina may know more, or I don't know if you know any more about why she chose, you know, the standard that's in her bill and why it doesn't exactly match the K-12 credit language.
Can, Mr. Chair, if we can stay with the
Section 26 for a minute, if I'm reading this correctly. This lifts, am I correct that this lifts the family cap on the tax credit?
Can you review for me how many people, or how many filers use the tax credit, the education tax credit each year, what the cost is to the state, things like that, please?
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, the Department of Revenue's most recent tax expenditure budget showed that about 60,000 taxpayers claimed the K-12 education credit in 2002, and the dollar amount cost of the credit is, I think, at $16.6 million in fiscal 05, and then it goes up over time.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Manzi, what does that give us for an average in terms of the average filer, what are they claiming of, what dollar value of educational expenses are they claiming under this provision?
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, that works out roughly to an average credit of $250. The credit is a 75% credit, so $250 is 75% of, and I'm not doing that very well in my head right now, but I think it's probably going to be around $325 or something like that would be what the expenditure was in order to qualify for the $250 credit.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Manzi, it seems that lifting the cap is not going to help, such as it is, the average filer who claims this credit.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, averages can be misleading. There may be a lot of people who have education-related expenditures of $100 or less, and a few people who have larger amounts, and there may be some people with large families who are making expenditures for more than two children who would benefit under this. There was a revenue estimate for a bill introduced relating to the family cap, which indicated that the lifting of the family cap alone would cost in the neighborhood of $400,000 a year. If you assume that they were getting the average credit for these additional kids, which may be a little unrealistic, they may be getting something less than average because the income levels don't really change, so the larger the family, the less likely they are going to be able to spend the required amount for more and more children as the income levels in place. But it seemed to indicate that there would be in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,500 additional children who would have the credit claimed on their behalf if the average were at 250, anything down to about 150.
Mr. Chair, may I move on to Section 28?
Representative.
Thank you. This is the what was referenced as the SECORA bill, the school tuition organizations. And it occurs to me that what we're doing here is offering individuals a disproportionate benefit for making contributions to these organizations. And I'm just wondering, and I'm not sure whether this is better for Mr. Michaels or Ms. Manzi, are there other places in the tax code where we provide a disproportionately large benefit to people for making certain specific charitable contributions versus other charitable contributions?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I think in both the Minnesota and the federal income tax, all charitable contributions qualify for the itemized deduction sort of equally, and I can't think of any credits that we now have for charitable contributions that would essentially, give one category of charitable contributions a higher tax benefit than another. There have been proposals that have come close to passing, particularly for contributions. The one that leaps to mind is there was a bill that passed both the House and the Senate but never made it through conference committee that would have allowed a charitable contribution credit for contributions of land for conservation purposes. But that's as close as I can come to thinking of an analogy to this.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Since you referenced the federal tax code, I'm wondering what the mechanics are then for this provision, because as I think it through, I make a contribution to one of these organizations. It's part of my charitable contributions. I claim that on my federal form, I reduce my income by whatever percent. I transfer that final number over to the Minnesota form. And then is this going to require a change in tax forms and the addition of a line to ensure so that there's a place for me to add back in the education, the contribution to this scholarship organization? And what are the mechanics here for the interplay between the federal and the state tax code on this question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, the way you described it is accurate. They're essentially, an individual who makes a contribution to one of these organizations, since it's highly likely to be a 501c3, will qualify as a charitable contribution. So the individual will get a tax benefit if they're an itemizer at the federal level, and that will flow through as federal taxable income. The bill, Representative Sikora's bill, did require, and this bill does too, require that to be added back under the additions section. And so there will be, on the M1M, which is the adjustments to income, there will be a line for that. So the taxpayer claim the deduction at the federal level and get a tax benefit that might range from 10% to 35%, depending upon their tax bracket. They'll add that back, so they won't get a benefit from the deduction at the state level, but they'll get a credit of 50% for that amount. And so they'll get a combined tax benefit of the 50% state credit plus the federal tax benefit. Now, to carry it all the way through, they also get an itemized deductions for state income taxes. And so by the credit reducing their state income tax, that will reduce the benefit of that deduction at the federal level, so there's a little bit of a feedback effect back to the federal tax. But the net benefit, you know, probably could be, depending upon their federal tax bracket, in the range of 60% to 75% probably more 60 to 70% in total federal and state tax benefits as a result of this.
Representative,
thank you. I need to clarify one thing that you just said, Mr. Michael, and then you sparked, unfortunately, another question. The other question before I lose that in my mind is, are we going to run into compliance problems with this, where I've given $100 to one of these STOs, I claimed it on my federal form, what's to prevent me from simply carrying forward the charitable deduction off the federal form, but then also applying for this? And then secondly, that feedback thing that you were talking about, I mean, it sounded like they're getting two scoops of ice cream off the deal. And I'm wondering if you can clarify that, because I lost track of you there.
Okay.
Mr. Michael.
To address, Mr. Chairman, the second question first, I think it would be a relatively easy thing for the department to audit that, because essentially what they would be able to do is to say taxpayer X has claimed the credit and filed the credit form. They could probably, unfortunately, it's not going to be machine entered, but they could just then pull that taxpayer's M1N and make sure that on that line for the adding back the STO contributions, that there's an amount there that's equal to the amount that was claimed on the credit. So I think that's not a compliance problem. In terms of the feedback effect, what I was trying to say is that because the credit reduces your state income tax and your state income tax is deductible, in effect, another way to think about this is when we give a tax benefit like this, it has the unintended consequence of raising federal revenues, because the federal government essentially will have a smaller deduction for state income taxes for Minnesota as a result of this, and so some taxpayers will pay more federal tax as a result of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Michael, Ms. Nancy.
Okay, if there are no further questions on Article 5, let's move to Article 6.
Article 6, I'll go through very quickly. This is a federal update article. And I think the simplest way to explain this is there are two deviations from what the governor was proposing. First, on the positive side, this bill conforms on on the married filing joint standard deduction for tax year 205 and 206. So we would have that essentially marriage penalty relief for those taxpayers, which was not in the governor's bill. On the negative side, it requires employers who pay for prescription drug benefits for their retirees and who receive from the federal government a subsidy payment to add that subsidy payment back. So those are the differences from what you heard when the governor's bill was presented.
Mr. Michael, just for clarification, how many returns does the standard deduction for married filing jointly impact? Remember that number?
We were huddling here, Mr. Chair, and that's a number none of us have on the top of our heads, but I'm going to hazard a guess that it's about 300,000.
Okay. Maybe we could just look that up for reference tomorrow.
It is a large number of taxpayers who are affected by that.
Thank you.
So Article 7 is the sales and use tax provisions. Section 1 is from the governor's bill. It says that any vendor who wants to contract with the state of Minnesota or various other agencies has to agree to collect the use tax if they're going to enter into those kinds of contractual relationships. Sections 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 are all from the Department of Revenue's bill and can be characterized as sort of minor or in the nature of cleanup, correction sorts of things. Section 9, along with a number of other sections, provides a sales tax exemption for the PRT equipment purchases. Section 10 is from one of the provisions from the governor's bill, which I won't go through those details, but that adopts the upfront payment of the sales tax on leases of motor vehicles. Sections 11, 12, and 13 are all, again, department changes that are, I think, part of the effort to fix our tax to be closer to streamlined. Section 14 is the first of several provisions that bring Minnesota's tax in compliance with the streamlined sales tax. And this, the department has estimated, will have a substantial effect in increasing revenues. What Section 14 does is to extend the exemption that we now have for pain relievers, analgesics, to all non-prescription medicine. And it also exempts things like mobility-enhancing devices. Currently, we just exempt prosthetics. And then it also limits the exemption for durable medical equipment to home purchases of that. And essentially, that makes purchases by providers of those kinds of equipment subject to tax. In some cases, those are currently exempt. So basically, what's going on here is by exempting non-prescription drugs and by taxing more durable medical equipment, it's pretty close to about a revenue-neutral wash in terms of the change in the tax base. But that, because that is in conformance with the streamlined sales tax definitions, this, we believe, will allow us to be one of the states that's part of streamlined, and that will result in a fair number of other of out-of-state vendors beginning to collect tax on behalf of Minnesota. Section 15 is another provision that's part of that package of changes. Section 16 is the chair's bill that extends the solar energy exemption. Section 17 is one of several provisions that convert the sales tax on cigarettes to essentially a wholesale level excise tax like tax instead of 21 cents in the first year based on the average retail price of cigarettes. Section 18 is the reversal of the court case in Great Lakes Transmission. That was a provision that the House passed last year, and that was also in the governor's bill. Section 19 is a collection of minor changes that I think largely came from the department's bill, but also includes a new provision that provides an upfront sales tax exemption for small, for small businesses that meet the general statutory definition. This is companies that either have 20 or fewer employees or $1 million or less in annual revenues. They will be allowed starting in fiscal year 2008 to essentially purchase capital equipment without paying the sales tax. They'll have to get a exemption certificate from the Department of Revenue in order to do that. Section 20 is the provision on the durable medical equipment that I described before. Section 23 is a Representative Van de Beer's bill that essentially makes some minor changes that aren't estimated to have any revenue effect on how the sales tax applies to tree, brush, stump, and stump removal. That's essentially treating that as an improvement to real estate rather than taxable landscaping service. Section 25 is Representative Gunther's bill that extends the nonprofit ticket exemption to Minsky that currently is applies to the University of Minnesota. Section 26, again, is part of the durable medical on the SSTP compliance. Section 27 is part of the PRT exemption. 28 is the exemption certificate for the small businesses, which I refer to. Section 30 is the upfront motor vehicle lease sales tax. Section 31 is and 32 is the flea market exemption. This was Representative Cole's bill. It was in last year's bill, Representative Jacobson's bill from last year. Section 33 is the local sales tax provision that authorizes Minneapolis and St. Paul to impose a 0.5% local sales tax for general fund purposes. Let's see, moving down, the 34, 35, 36 are all from the governor's or the Department of Revenue bill. 37 is a new provision that requires cities and counties that have local sales taxes to make more of an effort to notify their residents of their obligation to pay the use tax that's associated with those local sales taxes by notifying them of their obligation to do so on their website or through utility bills. Section 39 is Representative Bradley's bill that changes the permitted, makes a slight change in the permitted use of the Rochester sales tax. Section 41 is Representative Nelson and Simpson's bill on ready-to-eat meat and seafood, exempting that from the definition of prepared food. And Section 40 is Department of Revenue bill repealing some obsolete rules.
Okay, Representative Lucheski, questions to Article 7.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. Section 19, the capital equipment upfront exemption on the sales tax. I'm sorry, you said that was just for the small businesses with 20 or fewer employees with $1 million or less in revenues. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucheski, that's right. The one amendment to that is for professional and technical services firms can have up to $2.5 million in annual revenues.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, can you refresh my memory who carried that bill, and wasn't it for all companies? Didn't we hear that bill? Representative Nelson's waving at me.
That was Representative Nelson's bill.
Okay. So this is a part of that bill. If that's
the
start. Okay.
Mr. Representative Lucheski, as you know, I think the revenue note was about 80 million dollars. Obviously, no way to incorporate that with the revenue and target and the expenditure target. So, therefore, this is a small start in, I believe, in Pay 08. Is that correct, Mr. Michael? for a definition of small business that already exists in statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It's fiscal year 08, and it uses the general law definition of small businesses. Pat pointed out to me that very few professional or technical services companies would ever be engaged in manufacturing to qualify for this, which is probably correct.
Representative Luchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a general, broad, sweeping question about Article 7. It appears to me that this is really the article of the bill that comes up with all the money to pay for everything that's going on in the bill, and that is with the streamlined sales tax project compliance. And I'm wondering if you can, I know we have a spreadsheet and we haven't been referring to it as we've heard the presentation of the bill, because we know most of these provisions have a price tag, but it appears to me that, you know, canceling out, you know, state contracts with vendors that don't register and collect the sales in Minnesota, and then if we're going to come into compliance where you've already stated, Mr. Michael, that, you know, we'll give exemptions for certain things and we'll tax other things, and that revenue, it's, you know, as far as what's being coming to the sales tax system, it's kind of a wash. But while we're not getting the extra money from collecting on those, you know, taxing on those certain things, what we are getting is we're getting money because we're going to come into compliance with SSTP. Can you tell me for the 06-07 what that SSTP compliance generates and what we get for the 08-09 biennium in this bill?
Dr. Wilson, do you want to refer to the spreadsheet at this point?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Menchesky, on the spreadsheet, it would be line 44 on the second page. Increased tax revenues from voluntary payments. And if you see that line, it's about $40 million of increased payments in the first biennium and $110 million in the second biennium.
Representative Luchowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's a lot of money, $150 million over the two biennium. Can you tell me a little bit more, just generally, and maybe it's a question for Ms. Dalton, how solid that number is and how assured we can be that the state is really going to see that kind of money if this tax bill is basically, the way I read it, sort of based on that number? How can we better understand that that money is actually going to be real for us?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Luchowski, let me tell you first just how the calculations are done or what the Revenue Department is assuming, and then come back to your question. There was a study done in 2002 that estimated how large the sales tax gap was because of Internet and other remote sales. And they start with the estimates from that study. Those estimates were on the conservative side relative to other national studies done, so in some ways they damped down the estimate compared to what some studies from University of Tennessee and other places have done for Minnesota. They start with that number, and they basically assume that in fiscal year 2006, 7% of that gap would be closed through voluntary payments, and that rises up to 16% of the gap through voluntary payments by 2009. So the real question is, how realistic, first of all, is the study? Is the study of the gap correct? And secondly, are those reasonable assumptions to make? If the other parts of the streamlined sales tax package are passed here, it's almost certain that Minnesota would become, and only because of that, it would be able to become a member of the streamlined sales tax agreement or the group. Any company that voluntarily paid taxes in any of the member states would have to pay taxes voluntarily in Minnesota as well. So you're getting some benefit from what's happening, from what states think will be true in some other states. But as with all compliance estimates, these numbers do tend to be soft. I mean, we don't really have much experience to go with. It would probably be a good question to address to the department, or I can check before tomorrow or check tomorrow morning, get more information on exactly where the department came up with those percentages. I would say that the agreement itself is scheduled to go into effect in October of 2005. So this year, they are assuming that nothing will be really operational until January 1 of 2006.
So again, they're delaying in their estimates, they're basically delaying the start of the collections. So basic conclusion is the numbers are difficult to come up with, and the critical numbers, I think, are the 7% to 16% of the sales tax gap.
Representative Luchesko.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. If I may request then for the committee's benefit, some information, I know we're on a really tight schedule here, that could be pulled together to help the whole committee understand just how strong these numbers are and how much we can rely on them and what kind of variability we might see if we're wrong.
Okay. I see the commissioner over here, so I think he picked up on that we're going to ask for some additional information with regard to the calculations for the compliance portion of streamlined sales tax authority. Other questions then to Article 7, Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Michaels or Mr. Wilson or whomever, kind of along the lines of Representative Mancheski, but more on the kind of like a one-time savings, like the upfront vehicle lease payment and the cigarette sales tax at the wholesale level and the quarterly withholding of S Corps. How much money in this bill isn't going to be there in the next biennium? It's just here to balance the budget and shift the mess on to whoever's in power a year and a half from now.
Well, Representative Rukavina, these numbers are all based on you want to go through which ones you're asking about specifically again?
Well, Mr. Chair, what I'm saying is, you know, you're saving $14 million, it looks like, on the S-Corp, and, you know, $38 million this biennium on the upfront sales tax on vehicles, and $10 million or $11 million almost on the cigarette tax at the wholesale level, but that gets you through another biennium. Then after that, it's kind of, you know, like, I don't know where my Arnie Carlson quote's still in the packet, but, you know.
Well, Representative Rukavina,
you know, what he's saying is you're not really addressing the problem, and what I'm implying, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, not you, because most of these were the governor's proposals, but it gets you, you know, through this buying, let's say, the sales tax on the vehicles, you get 38, almost $39 million, but the next buying, you get six. So, you know, you lose $33 million hole you got there, the same with the S Corp. You collect $14 million this biennium, but you get two of the next, so now you got a $12 million hole. So how many of those are in the bill, Mr. Michaels?
I think what you're asking, Representative Rukavina, is how many of these are accelerated tax collections versus changes that would continue over time, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Michael, how many accelerated tax issues are there?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. That's not something that we've tabulated. We could go through and look for items where there's a drop in a drop in revenue from this biennium to next biennium or an increase in cost. I mean, one way to look at this, though, is to look at the net change in general fund revenue in each of the bienniums as a result of the bill. And, of course, that assumes that all these numbers, these estimates are correct. But if you look at that, if you look at line 57, for example, you'll see that for the 06-07 biennium, the net effect of the bill is, you know, estimated to be 158.6 million, and then if you look just over four columns to what the 08-09, or what generally people talk about as the tails, what the effect there is, it's 158.9. So it's not, you know, dramatically different when you net everything out. Yes, Representative Rukavina correctly points out a number of these provisions, like this shifting the cigarette tax upstream, requiring upfront payment of the lease fees and so forth, are clearly accelerations or shifts. But there are other provisions that offset those, at least in the estimation of the Department of Revenue's numbers.
If, Representative Rukavina, if you encourage your friends to smoke and drink more, the numbers will, that'll help.
Mr. Chair, my friends can't smoke or drink more than they do already. So. But maybe some of yours could. But, well, they could, but then we'll crash the criminal justice budget. Mr. Chair, Mr. Michaels, maybe for tomorrow when we go through this bill, you could just, for my clarification, then have a memo on what is kind of like a one-time, I would call it, one biennium maybe savings, and also what revenue would be estimating to make up that kind of money, because I'd like to know, you know, if they're being a little overly optimistic on what they think some of these other, like the streamlined sales tax or something as an example, where it increases dramatically, where I'd like to look at those too, because I think we're just really kind of setting ourselves up in the next biennium for a real hole, but that could be, I could be wrong.
Representative Rukavina, probably a response would better be from the Department of Revenue than from our own tax staff, but we could have Mr. Michael and our tax staff take a shot at that, but I said I think that's better to ask the Department of Revenue if they, well, how sure they are about their numbers that they provide us with all of these various proposals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's probably a better suggestion. Was Mr. Salamone still here?
He's attentively listening to
God, he's lost so much weight, I can't even recognize him. He's looking for a big guy out there.
Okay, if there are no more I'm sorry, Representative Mueller, you had a question to Article 7.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't know who, maybe Mr. Wilson. I see PRT in here about three times. What is the cost of that?
Dr. Wilson? Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, the cost of the PRT provision, the only cost is from the sales tax, one of the sales tax exemption. It shows up on line 39 of the spreadsheet, and it's a $200,000. The estimate is $200,000 cost in 2009. There is you have to be operational PRT, personal rapid transit systems. There is in Duluth, there is the potential for an experiment, sort of a trial run that would be potentially up by that time. And so the Department of Revenue has put the cost on in 2009 in their estimates.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that's all it would be is $200,000?
The reason for Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, the reason for the low estimate is because nothing else would be up and operational is the assumption. And so it's a experimental technology.
Okay, if there are no other questions to Article 7, let's Article 8, Mr. Mark.
Chairman, Article 8 is the special taxes article. Section 1 is the new franchise fee that's imposed on card clubs at racetracks at a 15% rate. This is essentially the same provision that passed in the House last year, except the rate is higher. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 are all from either the governor's or the department's bill in terms of Minnesota CARE provisions. Section 6 is the chair's bill that essentially prohibits state agencies from including on their websites links to out-of-state pharmacies unless those pharmacies are selling drugs on which the Minnesota CARE tax has been paid, or if the pharmacy agrees to collect that tax from the purchaser. Section 7 is a combination of two of Representative David's bills. relating to the transfer or what's called the pass-through authority under the Minnesota Care Tax. All of these are an effort to make it clear that providers can essentially bill the insurance or health plan company for the tax that they're paying on these various transactions. Section 8, the FER tax provision, is again from the department's bill. This is just a sort of a payment date sort of thing. Section 9 is the moving the entire sales tax rate, converting that into a retail gross receipts tax. That's an attempt to comply with streamlined sales tax. Section 10 through... through 21 are all special tax provisions related to linked bingo, cigarettes, and tobacco products from the Department of Revenue's bill. Section 22 is the provision that's been discussed briefly that converts the sales tax on cigarettes to a per pack tax based on average retail price in the previous year. Section 23 is the allowing small payers of small amounts of liquor, alcoholic beverage taxes to file either quarterly or annually rather than monthly. Section 24 is a provision from the governor's bill that reverses the Blue Cross Blue Shield case on stop loss coverage. Sections 26 and 28 are Representative Abrams' bill and also is a governor's supplemental rec that reduces the premium tax on life insurance from 2% to 1.5%. Section 29 is Representative Dill's bill for Masaba Nugget. Sections 30, 31, and 32 are the also governor's or Department of Revenue provisions, the fee on, or the penalty on solid waste and the floor stocks tax to complement the cigarette tax provisions.
Any questions on Article 8? If not, I'm sorry, Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 6, the referrals to foreign pharmacies.
Representative Lincheski, is the same language in legislation that I introduced, and because discovery that foreign or out-of-state pharmacies are not necessarily required, nor are they informing the purchasers of prescription drugs that they are paying the use tax for on the 2% provider tax. So this would require that on the state website, that either these out-of-state pharmacies would need to sign an agreement with the Department of Revenue to remit the provider tax, or they would need to inform the purchaser that they're responsible for paying use tax. Representative Chesky.
Mr. Chair, just on that, I'm wondering if maybe tomorrow we could get an attempt by, I don't know who, Revenue, to tell us, I'm thinking about this as it relates to the governor's proposal or the website that you can buy your drugs in Canada. I've never been to it, so I'm not really sure how that all works. But if, from the consumer's standpoint now, who's going to the website to get the Canadian drug for less cost than it is in Minnesota, does the requiring the use tax to be collected as it should be under law be paid for, you know, the MinCare tax? Does that net out that from the consumer's perspective or the purchaser that it makes the drug the same price as though it were being purchased in state? Or is there still a benefit to the consumer when this provision is implemented? And I'm just wondering if if it basically makes it that, you know, there's no benefit now to purchase your drugs that way, or if you're still ahead.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn Chesky, I don't know anything about this, but my guess would be that the margins are much greater than the wholesale drug tax, which is 2%. I can't imagine anybody's buying drugs from Canada to save 2%.
Mr. Michael, I guess it triggers a question on my mind. Is there, in current statute, is there a de minimis use tax with regard to the 2% provider tax or not?
Mr. Chairman, there is not. There is a de minimis like that in the sales tax, but there is not in the Minnesota Cure Use Tax.
So even if an individual purchased $50 worth of Canadian drugs over the internet, and they would still be responsible for the 2% provider tax, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And of course, you could leap to the conclusion, okay, they owe us a dollar, but the trouble is it's based on the wholesale price, which they may not know, or they won't know, I think, likely.
Mr. Chair. Representative Mone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to that, Mr. Michael, can we require Canadians, or can they even, I don't know how they, do they register for collection of use tax? I haven't heard of ever doing it from, other states do it, but there's something within the country. What about other countries?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulery, I think we certainly would not have any power to compel them to do it, but I think that this is sort of analogous to the governor's proposal that says if you want to sell goods to the state of Minnesota, you have to register to collect our use tax. And this would sort of be analogous. If you want the marketing advantage of being linked on our website in order to presumably make a reasonable profit selling more product to Minnesota purchasers, that the price of doing that, the price of getting that marketing link on our website, is that you have to then start, collecting and remitting this tax to the state. I think that's the basic idea that's in this provision. So it would not be that we can compel them, but to say that, look, as a quid pro quo for getting a link, which will direct potentially a lot of business to you, you'll have to agree to collect this tax.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. I understand. I didn't think we could require them, but there is no problem then, I didn't know the governor's was for other countries on the other issue, but so there's no, the other countries can, do they now do anything like this with Minnesota, where we have anybody collecting use tax from other countries?
Well, Representative Mulery, as I think as Schmeichel pointed out, if you're contracting with the state, whether you're from Arizona, New York, or whether you're a foreign firm contracting with the state of Minnesota, that you'd be responsible to pay the sales tax. And this is a similar type provision. If you want to be listed on the website, you don't have to be listed on the website, but if you want to be listed on the website, then the reciprocal is that then you would need that agreement to pay the provider tax for the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mulery.
Yes, what I was just, I'm not that strong on NAFTA or GATT or all of those different types of things. I just wondered if in any way those could affect it. Or.
Mr. Mike.
Chairman, Representative Mulery, I think this provision is a neutral provision. It's not sort of treating international or foreign vendors any differently than U.S. vendors. It simply says this would apply, to obviously the problem maybe that it's sort of targeted to foreign vendors, but it as the chair pointed out, I think it's, you know, it's just a voluntary agreement, and it's sort of the state is acting more as a market participant here than as a regulator. It's sort of getting into the advertising business in a way, really.
Representative Rukavina, Article 8.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, regarding the, you know, the extension of the alcohol tax, which, you know, last year when I did it, it was a tax increase, but this year it isn't, so that's another point. But I'm just curious as to the numbers. Why do you, in a half a year, only save $23 million instead of, like, $30 million, which what I would think would be the number since the full year is $60 million. See what I'm saying?
Or Mr. Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, these taxes are collected with a lag of a month, so that you would get 5/12 instead of 6/12.
If there are no further questions to Article 8, let's go on to Article 9.
Mr. Chairman, before I talk about Article 9, a couple of things. First of all, we do have now the answer to your question about the number of taxpayers for, and I was low by a substantial margin, for tax year 205 at the half a million taxpayers that are there, half a million married filing joint taxpayers. That drops off a little bit, but that's the range. The second thing is also with regard to the income tax article. We inadvertently failed to include Representative Johnson's bill, Representative Jeff Johnson's bill that provided for electronic advancing the payment dates for electronic payments of property tax refunds. We'll have that as an author's an amendment for you when you get the markup. So, okay.
Thank you for both of those points.
Article 9 is the economic development provision. Most of these I won't go over because they're from Representative Magnus's bill that narrows and limits a little bit the Job Z provisions. I will note the other provisions that were not part of Representative Magnus's bill. The other thing I should say, on Representative Magnus's bill, he had a couple of provisions that expanded the Job Z program that had a cost. For example, there was allowing sales tax exemptions for this aerial photography company. That those provisions are deleted. So it's just the provisions that sort of change and narrow the Job Z qualification rules. Section 6 is Representative Lanning's bill that provides an additional 2 years of money for the border city zones on the western border. Section 18 is Representative Nornes's bill that allows the city of Fergus Falls to hold property tax exempt for economic development purposes for 15 years rather than for 8 years. Section 19 is Representative Nelson's bill that provides a border city development zone in the city of Taylor's Falls with a $100,000 allocation of state tax benefits. All the rest of the provisions are those Job Z provisions that either were developed by Representative Magnus, Steed, or Revenant.
Representative Lincheski, Article 9.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 4 and 5, I remember Representative Broad and Representative Pepin had bills in this area. Are these, does this represent Broad, Pepin, neither, or partial of something they were offering at that time?
Michael. Yes. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, you caught me in skipping the one section that was not from Representative Magnus's bill. This provision was not part of Representative Broad's or Pepin's bill. Both of those allocated additional monies to fund the bioscience zones. What this does is, under present law, those authorizations will cancel at the end of this biennium. What this provision says is if they haven't used up all of their allocations, they will carry forward to the next biennium. Article 10 is the miscellaneous provisions. Sections 1 and 2 are from the Department of Revenue's bill. Sections 3 through 11 are from Representative Thiessen's bill that makes a number of changes in the rules governing the regulation of tax preparers by the Department of Revenue. Probably the most significant of those is Section 11, which provides for publication of a list of preparers that have been penalized by the department. Sections 12, 13, 14 are all from the Department of Revenue's bill relating to essentially collection of taxes. Section 15 is Representative Simpson's bill that essentially makes it clear that petty misdemeanor fines can be collected under the revenue recapture provision. This article also repeals the political contribution refund program, and so there are a number of sections in here that eliminate cross-references to that, you'll note. The sections 20, 21, 22, 23 are all from the Department of Revenue's bill. Similarly, 25 and 26. Section 27 is the chair's bill that provides a statutory definition for tax to essentially refer to anything that the government imposes that's not a market transaction between the private entity and the government. Section 28 is Representative Broad's bill that proposed that provides for a tax reform commission, which will, over a four-year period, submit reports and recommendations on four major categories of taxes: business taxation, sales tax, individual income, and then all other taxes. Section 29 is a transfer from the tax relief account, which is repealed in Section 31. When the K-12 bill changed the property tax recognition shift, they do that in tenths of a percent, and as a result of rounding, there was $3.4 million left in that account, and this transfers it to the general fund. Section 30 is a quarter of $1 million appropriation for taxpayer assistance grants by the Department of Revenue. This is Representative Walker's bill. Section 31 has the repeal of the political contribution refund program and the tax relief account. That is the bill.
That is the amendment.
The amendment. Excuse me.
Are there any questions to Article 10? Any additional questions with any of the other articles? Thank you very much, members. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a process question again now for tomorrow. We'll do testimony, you said, and then if we complete that after session, if testimony then completes, we start with the amendments. And I appreciate that you don't have a 24-hour rule, and I know that our members will be working diligently now to work with staff to have amendments.
I can't understand why you'd want to amend this fine piece of work.
But. Do you have any, do you anticipate do you anticipate a lull in the action anywhere as, you know, some of the other members are already in Ways and Means, some are, you know, doing other things, and if everything can't get to staff by tonight.
Well, Representative Lucheski, first of all, I think for the edification of members as well as other interested parties, we will go through the spreadsheet tomorrow morning, just so people have a better idea of the numbers. And then Representative Rukavina asked those questions about the calculations, where those revenue estimates might be better or softer, and we'll have the Department of Revenue actually give us some additional information or have an opportunity for members to give questions to the Department of Revenue. Then we'll take public testimony. We have session tomorrow at 11 a.m. So once again, we don't know how long session or how long we'll be in session, but come back after session. Further questions or deliberations by members, and then, as I said, when we are ready, we can start the amendment process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that clarification. I just wanted to know if you were going to be providing pizza tomorrow night, then.
It's not the chair's habit to feed members. That just usually sustains them for a longer period of time and, results in more amendments. Members, if you want to leave materials here, you're welcome to do that. We will lock the room this evening. We will be back in this room tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. So again, if you want to leave anything, the staff will lock the room. So there's nothing further. Meeting is adjourned.